podcast with a K. Welcome to the podcast. I'm Christian Corley. I'm joined today by James McLean. Hello, James.
Hello there.
I'm Brian Turnover.
That's this guy.
That's that guy there. He gets to pick up because he hasn't been on the podcast for a few weeks. He's been busy.
That's right.
What have you been doing? Time traveling through other galaxies, something like that?
Yes. As a matter of fact, I was in a different galaxy, far, far away in Orlando, Florida, at the Star Wars convention down here. So a galaxy far. Anyway, yeah. So yeah, yeah.
Cool. How was that? How was it? Was it good?
You know, I'll be honest. The first day that we went, we were a little underwhelmed. But we had a 4-day pass, and we weren't sure if we were always going to make 4 days. We always intended at least one of those days we were going to go down to the beach. So we did do that. So we made the first and the last day of the con. And I have to say the last day was a lot more fun than the first day. So there was just a lot more going on, and we saw other areas that – layout-wise, it wasn't exactly the best layout for a con, which is kind of why we had kind of lost our feel for it on the first day. But it was pretty fun. A lot of good things. Harrison Ford showed up as a surprise guest, which was kind of cool, obviously. I say kind of cool, I mean extremely cool. But yeah, it was a fun event.
Okay. Did you get to see Rogue One yet?
No.
Okay. Note to self.
No, I haven't.
Note to self.
I'll tell you what, though. Buy
Blu-ray version of Rogue One for Brian.
Right. I probably have, finger quotes, seen it. Just by everything I know about it. And the little clips and the so on. But yeah. It'll be seen one day.
Okay, good on. Right. Well, I mean, I've been battling the bulge this past week. An absolute deluge of Easter eggs landed in our house last weekend, so bit of a weight thing going on there. I don't know if you're experiencing the same thing, dear listener. James McLean's probably had one extra brandy or something in the past week.
No, I've had eggs.
You've had eggs as well?
Absolutely.
Are they
no
Harrod's eggs? Harrod's eggs?
Harrod's eggs, yes. Yes, made by the family themselves under strict orders in my special chocolate house for them to put those chocolate eggs together. I've had a few eggs and I was absolutely fine.
Good, oh.
No extra bulging.
Good for you. I'm glad to hear it. I'll just close my email, otherwise I'm going to get distracted. That's a professional podcasting tip for all you wannabe podcasters over there. So we are here to, we've convened to discuss episode 2 of Doctor Who Series 10, Smile. That's not an instruction, that's the name of the episode. In which the Doctor and Bill travel forward in time to see what humanity's descendants get up to on a distant colony world. Sounds a bit familiar, doesn't it? You put it that way.
It's a bit
new
tab,
Earth,
yeah.
Isn't it? You got nanobots, you got robots, look a bit like the old, around 10 years ago, there was a Japanese robot called, what was it called? Akido or something like that. They're similar sort of design to that, but with the emoji faces. And there's a few guest appearances of people that have been in Doctor Who or the surrounding universes before. I think there was a... Someone who'd been in Sarah Jane Adventures was in there, I think, early on. Nice adventure. I thought it was a nice, well shot. The CGI and the location work seemed to be pretty seamless. Brian, you weren't here last week, so what did you think of Smile? Because you've just watched it,
Smile,
haven't you?
Smile or last week?
This week, Smile, yeah.
Oh, this week's? I actually enjoyed it.
Yeah,
I thought it was a pretty good one. I'm curious because, like you said, good location work. Where was that location? Do we know that?
Not
Spain,
at the moment.
Wasn't it?
Was it Spain? Was that what they went over to Spain for? Was it?
I believe so.
Surprised me.
I read that.
That was a really nice location. I liked it. I mean, I have two negative points that I'd like to talk about while we're in the podcast. One of them's kind of a minor negative, but I enjoyed it. I liked the pace. I loved the setting, the cinematography. One of my favorite shots in the entire thing was when they found the spaceship at the end And the doctor was basically getting down to the engine room, and he was climbing down a ladder staircase. Just the angle that they chose, and I wish I could point it out a little bit better, but I just loved the shot. The framing of that shot was gorgeous. So the director, who I probably should look up since I'm praising their work right now, really, really enjoyed their work. And the writer of this episode, Lawrence Gough, who was the writer again?
It was Frank Cottrell Boyce.
I didn't catch that at the beginning.
Frank Cottrell Boyce, who previously covered The Planet in Trees.
Okay, well, redeemed himself with this episode. In my opinion.
Okay. Yes, he did In the Forest of the Night back in 2014. James McClane.
Yeah, I really liked it. It was very good. I think given
dear listener, you are listening to the podcast with a K. Just when
it comes. I know, Tuesday. Two people. Like last week, it was really well done. It feels like a different show at the moment.
It does.
Capaldi seems consistent, relaxed, and confident. The companion seems to be consistently well written and used well. Mm-hmm. And the stories had a very interesting pace. It was quite a slow pace. I think my same reservation is the same reservation we talked about last week, is that I still don't think this was anywhere near something that kids would go near for both pacing and for content. Yeah. The opening teaser was pretty gruesome, I think.
Yes.
But personally speaking, I really enjoyed it. As an adult, I enjoyed it. So I couldn't fault it.
What were you going to say there, Brian?
Oh, I was going to say I agree with James that it seems like a nice change for Capaldi, a good step. The main thing for me was, aside from the sonic screwdrivers in the first episode and the photo of Riversong and Susan, it feels fresh. It feels like the change we should have had in 2010 to me, to be honest. Certainly the change we should have had for Capaldi's first season.
Yes.
Because it feels freer of continuity, even though Moffat's still trying to put in like continuity there, certainly in the first episode. And in a sense, some of it, I feel, should be there and some of it makes sense. But it's what it's more so free of, rather than like the classic sonic screwdrivers and Susan, for example, with the exception of the photo of Riversong, it feels like it's free of the continuity of the Moffat era, which the continuity of his era alone has bogged down his era alone. And these last two episodes just feel like a fresh, clean slate, which is what they were saying this was going to feel like. But it really does. It really feels very comfortable to watch, very enjoyable to watch. The episodes themselves, I agree with James as well, is maybe not the most kid-friendly episode, maybe even not the most kid-captivating episode, as he said. But the one main thing that got me is that these first two episodes are still stories of either accidents or misunderstandings causing the issues rather than some alien invasion force. So we're partway there, I feel, but we're not fully there yet. And that's okay to have a mix. Like, I don't think those accidental stories should stop. It's just two in a row now of that, where the universe is just a bunch of like random accidents anymore rather than anyone with malicious intent.
Okay. Well, we have.
So I'd like to see that.
We have yet to come Ice Warriors, Cybermen, Masters, plural. So there's obviously a few antagonists that should be in the mix. I think one of the things I wasn't over keen on, and this is only a very minor thing, we're talking about structural, is we're still going back and we're playing that same record of introducing the companion, take it to the past or the future, then take it to the past or the future. Hmm. And it's like, we've done this so many times, I don't kind of feel like it's needed. Why does she have to pick? Why can't they just go to a place and it's in the past or the future? That sort of structure doesn't feel required. So it seems very odd that where everything else feels very fresh, that it's going back to these same things, which the show's has already admitted on a couple of occasions. This is something overtrodden. I can't remember, was it Amy or Clara? One of them was sort of saying you did this. Oh, no, was it Martha? Said, you did this with your previous girlfriend slash sort of idea. And that was odd. I kind of felt like why we need that. I don't think we need it anymore. I know in a sense he's rebooting this, so maybe he's feeling he needs to take those beats again.
We might be getting it again next year though, under those circumstances, if we think about it.
Yeah, well, I think that from his point of view will be a Chibnall's situation. Yeah. And I still wonder, as much as I'm enjoying the season, whether there is a bit of politics being played out here, that he's almost stealing these moments, which should be Chibnall's, to reboot it. And but I really have enjoyed the last two episodes, so I don't care.
Yeah.
But these are some of the things I talk about.
Hmm. You know, a few weeks ago we were talking about the 12th Doctor's character.
Yes.
And his inconsistency during the last series. Now, yeah. my wife, when we watched Telly together, pretty much she's silent unless she has a comment to make about shipping. Okay.
Okay.
Which goes over my head. But last night she pointed out that she much prefers Capaldi because he's like the old Capaldi, going back to 2014.
Yeah.
Now, if my wife's noticed that, she's not the most forthcoming when TV's on. So I think he's been fantastic the last couple of episodes. He just felt so comfortable, relaxed. The Doctor, he hasn't felt like, I think you described him as old Matt Smith, didn't you? There doesn't seem to have been any of that. He feels more like, he just feels...
But he's not quite the same as Series 8, even though...
No. He's a little bit less...
He's a calmer version.
But yeah.
Yes. I mean, one of our colleagues, Richard, would probably argue, as he has done the forum, that, you know, the first season he's grumpy, then he comes to accept himself with Clara, then obviously he goes through his happy phase with Clara and he comes out this other side as a sort of slightly wiser doctor. I don't care. The thing is, the bottom line is the second series, he was boring as hell. Whatever way you want to argue it, first series, he was inconsistent as hell. He just seemed to flip between being silly, jumping around idiot and this very dark, manipulative character, which was quite fun. And this series, he seems to be a little more mid-road, doesn't he? He's not as antagonistic or as distant or as uncaring or as alien as he was sort of being pushed in the sort of Malcolm Tucker sort of doctrines in Listen, Time Heist, Mummy on the Orient Express, etc. He's a far more leveled out, and it works. I think this is a really nice medium. I'm watching this, and yeah, my mother said, she was watching it, and she said, I don't know why I didn't like this character before. And she didn't like him before this. So this series has been a change, which has, as you're sort of saying, has sort of tapped into people who aren't so intrinsically focused in the show and notice these nuances. People who are just watching it seem to feel they're connecting to the main character, which, given where we know where this is all going, is such a bloody shame that it's happening now.
Yeah.
But at least it means he'll get, if it carries on like this, he'll get a good outing. And as we've said a million times before, if you have a good ending, that can cement your legacy.
Yeah.
Crossed.
It might all be nonsense, though. Maybe he's staying. Maybe it's all been a big lie.
Well, my concern is that obviously we've got these talks about the Christmas special and the finales, which sounds so hideously series continuity convoluted that it disappoints me to think that from all these really nicely balanced episodes where the intercontinuity is, as Brian alluded to, very light, superficial stuff that fans will get that doesn't interfere with the story, and that we might end up going down the usual path for the finale, which is such a shame.
Well, at the moment, it's just rumours, and I would suggest we cast our minds back to 2005, and in the week before the final episode of the first series, someone put on IMDb that Norman Lovett of Red Dwarf was playing Davros in the final episode.
Yeah, but we still know that we have got John Sim, Ice Warriors, Cybermen. I'm saying Varney's
later in the series. Yeah, but not all in one go.
No, absolutely not. But what I'm saying is, at the back end of the series, you've at least got Missy, Cybermen, and John Sim at the very least, regardless of those extra names that are being mentioned, and all sitting around a similar sort of theme. And you're right. Hopefully, we're wrong, and this is the sort of tone and pace he's going to play it, and that would be absolutely wonderful, I think, for Capaldi's final series, because it's just letting him breathe. The story is the pace is slowed down, so there's more character moments, and so they're able to talk. And for Doctor Who, maybe this is, we haven't even, I don't think we really even had this in Russell T. Davis's era, where they're actually able to sort of breathe and chat and sort of communicate in a way which feels really fresh. You know, she can ask questions which sound like questions that would legitimately be asked without sounding forced. Hmm. And he can respond and feel those pauses. He can make breaks. There's no, it's been really, really good like that. You're getting to the sort of very crux of British drama in a sense, where we didn't have the money to have lots of effects and cutaways to lots of different expensive scenes. We had to rely on narrative and dialogue. And at the moment, we're getting a bit of that. And I'm not saying that's the only way to do Doctor Who, because as we've all said, well, there's lots of sort of Doctor Who's they've done since 2005 that we all love. So it's not saying that it has to go backwards to that sort of thing, but it's nice seeing it explore that sort of pace. And it just freshens the show knowing you've got that sort of that sort of structure that you can actually employ and it still work. So,
Yeah, it would be really nice to see this trend of these first two episodes continue throughout his series. I mean, when you realize like how many episodes are left, the worry does start to set in that the ball will be dropped. But it would be really nice. It does remind me of, and even though this reflects more so on the character than the series, because I feel the series went downhill, but when the Pons left and Clara came in, there was a massive change in Matt Smith's characterization of the Doctor, which made me like him.
Yes.
During Clara's yes. era. But I liked him. I didn't quite like the stories that followed for the most part. Mm. Whereas here, you know, like, we talked about this before with Series 9. When Clara left at the end of Series 8, she should have been gone. Series 9 should have been Series 10, what we're getting right now. It should have been that fresh, clean slate, because she just bogged things down and it didn't work. So it's interesting to see what a new companion can do, what a new relationship can do. And maybe that's what it is. Maybe like the head writers and the writers are getting stuck in a rut of, this is how the Doctor and this companion interact, this is how heavy it should be, this is how they should be, and you know, getting in new blood, it frees them up because they can't think of new things to do. Although that's not really fair to say, considering Series 9, Clara just was whatever they needed her to be per episode. So I don't know, whatever they're doing right now, it's working.
I think a lot
and that's good.
I think a lot of it is the dialogue, because I mean, while the dialogue is very colourful still, but it's not pushy, it's not Buffy anymore. And it felt like in the last few series, certainly since 2010, it's been quickfire joke after quickfire joke from everyone, be it the Doctor, be it Amy. They're just sort of backwards and forth. It's like a combatant of who can be the most ludicrous. And that seems to have died down. There's not much, Capaldi doesn't really make many of those sort of jokes, which suits him. And nor does Bill. Bill sort of makes sort of silly, makes observations and does them in a sort of slightly snorty, nervous voice. And that's fine. That sort of works. But it's not this constant trying to do the most amazing one-liner. And somehow that gives the show some depth to it, or clarity, or it feels like it takes itself seriously rather than it's trying to outplay itself at how clever it can be. And I think that is part of what's working, is that I'm not... Yeah. Wait, does not sitting through lots of, oh yeah, that's a very clever line, I think it's a very clever line, doesn't really fit, or that just belittles the situation. You know, the Doctor in this episode, and I think this is another factor, he didn't ever do the sort of Tom Baker thing, and obviously the Matt Smith thing and the Capaldi thing and even the Tennant thing to a degree. He'd taken the last set of antagonists, he's taken very, very seriously. There's never been a moment where he sent them up at all. Even the emoji ones, he never sent up. The Vardy was kept, were spoken about never in anything less than seriousness. And the same last week as well. So maybe it's also that. Maybe there's a sort of, the way that the Doctor's interrogating the world around him is changing, and that's freshening it up. It's not feeling like the same recycled sort of Buffyisms, which maybe one of the problems for Doctor Who was, is it started doing the Buffyisms, you know, a few years after Buffy had finished. And now we're like, you know, over how many years is it since Buffy finished now? And it was still doing it until this series. And maybe that's why it feels fresh. I don't know. I'm just spitballing here.
Mm. We're done to that.
You know, it's interesting that you would say the same recycled kind of thing, because it's one thing I wanted to point on, that we still have a story arc. So the same recycled idea of doing a story arc is there.
Right.
But this one actually seems interesting, even though I kind of personally have a sense I feel like I already know where it's going, and maybe I'll be wrong. But it actually seems interesting. I'm curious to find out who the Doctor made this deal with, what's in the vault, and so on. Like, it's actually interesting.
But they're not.
But it
pushing.
Also brings. Go on.
That's
no,
probably why
not.
It works. There's no push. There's exactly. No feeling that this is a marketing ploy, which in every season, including Ted Davis's, it started to feel like a marketing ploy.
It's more like the Time War in Series 1.
Yes.
Where we have things to learn about why the Doctor's been away so long, or what's happened in the gap between the Doctors, between 8 and 9. You know, it's more interesting like that. We slowly will be learning about this. He's giving dismissive answers, you know, or coy answers. And I like all that. But it also kind of made me okay with an aspect that I wasn't okay with. Which is Nardole, however you want to say it, Nardole. Anyway, I didn't like the fact that, you know, here's the second episode in. The Doctor already has one companion. Now he's picked up Bill, and the Doctor wants to leave with Bill and not Nardole, who's his companion. And I was like, oh, man, why do we have to keep having that? Why can't we have the two companion situation rather than the sometimes yes, sometimes no? But now I'm wondering, even though they say that the Doctor put him back together, I'm getting a sense, and hopefully it'll be true, but I'm getting a sense that the Doctor made a deal to watch this vault, and Nardole is part of that deal. He's kind of watching the Doctor, in a sense, or watching the vault with him. Like, that's his job, to watch this vault and, you know, maybe sometimes leave, do certain things, whatever. And that makes me feel a little bit better about it. Like, he's got a purpose. He's got a role. And he's not as annoying as he was in the Christmas episode with River Song, the husbands of River Song. He's toned down. He's not the most interesting character, I will be honest. But it's nice because it frees Bill and the Doctor up to be their own thing while there's still this other aspect there that we still have things to learn about. So somehow, a part I was really dreading, I'm now kind of interested in.
I'm liking the university as well as a base, because while we've had the Doctor keep coming back for, you know, to the homes of the companion, I kind of don't mind this idea that, oh, again, I know it's sort of playing on the unit era, where he's got where he has a spot to come back to. That doesn't bother me. That works. Again, it feels a little fresh. And I know we're not blowing, we're not sort of saying, I told you so, but these are sort of things that we were sort of saying back when Series 8 was about to start, that these were sort of simple little ideas that they could just employ that could just freshen it up a bit. Just how you take the dialogue, how you add an extra companion, how you take away sort of romances, how you take it away, you know, recentering the Doctor on Earth in this sort of way. It's just these little minor things that can just change it enough that the structures that they do want to keep, like you say, Brian, like the story arc, like I said, you know, having the sort of go to the past, go to the future sort of thing, it doesn't feel too old because you've just got enough to give it a little bit of extra flavour. So what about you, Christian? Because you've not really spoken on this yet.
Well, I just generally loved it. I sat there enjoying all of it. I loved the pace, the dialogue. Felt relaxed and easy, and even for, you know, that whole, you know, this is something brand new to Bill, they managed to communicate that. She managed to communicate that. Pearl Mackie's excellent, isn't she? She's just effortlessly stepped into the companion role. I was thinking towards the end, how likely would it be that they'd make this arse up of this kind with regards to programming the Vardis. And there is that element that Brian said of it being sort of like a mistake, or, you know, like a creature being malevolent because it doesn't know any better. That sort of side to it. And then I thought about it. It's an IT project, isn't it? Yeah. And IT projects go wrong all the time. So, or they don't develop in the way they're supposed to develop. People make stupid mistakes, couldn't work with a hangover, leave bugs in there. I was happy with that. I got over that thought. So it feels like a completely different show, and
it does. Yeah,
it's like the show that I've kind of wanted since 2014.
Well, since 2009 for me, to be honest.
Well, I'm talking about just Capaldi. Really.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Since Peter Capaldi was cast, this is what I've wanted. And I'm delighted we've got it. Little bit sad that we're only going to get it for a year, but no, it's just lovely. There's some comments on Facebook I'm going to drop into quickly.
Sure.
From our listener. In his guise as Tom Ford, our listener says, a mixed bag. Interesting first half with a lacking second. The one time a soft reset with the Sonic is reasonably justified and it ends up with a sort of Boy Who Cried Wolf scenario. Jonathan Roberts, interesting idea for a story but didn't quite hit the mark. Typical second episode. Alex Tai found it ordinary and got a little bored in the second half, but in general he's saying it feels the series is holding its own and feels fresh while Billy's charming and Capaldi's brilliant. He says, is there a mirror image backwards thing going on, given the ship's name Nowhere was backward and last week was about reflections, which is interesting. Because that refers to something
and
that
not
I've...
being backwards in the reflections.
Yeah, and that refers to something that I've heard about, rumoured, which I may expand on later. And Nigel Webb also, will give you a mention, Nigel, thanks for your comment. Likes the interplay between Bill and the Doctor. Didn't mind the reset button. And likes the Scotland in space line. Is there a Scotland in space? They're all over the place demanding independence from every planet they land on.
Yeah, that was an interesting line. I was wondering whether that would fuel some fires. The reset button was interesting because at the time when I realised it was the reset, I think, yeah, at first I was a bit like, is that it? And then I think, as you say, if you start looking at it as a sort of allegory for sort of algorithmic computer, you know, IT development, then it sort of makes a sensible, it is a sensible deploy of a reset button.
Yeah.
And it has interesting connotations as well, which part of me would like them to go into a little more. You know, they open this big sort of powder keg of totally intolerant humans stuck in this situation, which I doubt at any point after he left they felt was any less than intolerant and intolerable and awful. And you don't see what happened. But again, and I'm not saying that, you know, the classic series was the right way to do it, because the classic series itself was a myriad of different styles over 25 years or more. But it did kind of felt okay to leave it there. It's as if, fine, you know, that's the sort of thing that Doctor Who does do. It sets up a new situation. You might not always know the resolution to that, because he moves on, but the status, the situation of that story has been resolved and it's left open for everything else. And who knows, 2 days later, maybe the Vardy have had to just wipe out all those people for just being, you know, dicks. But
or maybe the people reprogram them.
Or they reprogram them, yes, and to make sure that they only responded to them being happy, or, you know, you don't know. So there is a kind of, it kind of still worked. And I agree with some of those comments. It didn't totally blow me away. You know, the story was very nice. I thought there's some very nice ideas in it. The whole idea of the emojis on your back and the reasoning behind that, that the actual prop itself, the way you couldn't see it on one side, that was very Stephen Moffat era, nicely played. As you say, the aesthetics were really strong all the way through. It had a really interesting, fresh feel to it. I think going down into the bowels of the ship was good because it gave a nice change to the aesthetic as well. There was a tension through the first half that was set up well in the teaser. So you were feeling that tension when they were exploring the city. That was brilliantly done. Perhaps it did become a little more predictable in its second half, not necessarily predictable, but a little more formulaic to Doctor Who. But overall, I think, again, I don't think it'll ever people look back and say this is the best Doctor Who, even though it's quite beautiful. I think it will probably mar over time. I think it will lack its finish, a bit like as you know, I never remember, is it The Unquiet Dead or is it
The Unquiet Dead? Yes,
yeah, whatever. I think it might have that sort of thing where the sort of beauty and the pacing might sort of feel a bit stale after several watches, but here and right now it's just what the show needs. That's really cool.
It's pretty much exactly how I felt watching it. Like, it was good, it was enjoyable, and like, I wasn't sitting there dreading it like the Christmas story, the superhero one.
Yes.
That I just sat there dreading every second.
Thanks, Brian.
Yeah.
You know, well, seriously, like, looking at my watch the whole time thinking, what the hell are you doing here? These last two stories I watched, and in the back of my mind I kept thinking, like, how's he going to screw it up, how's this going to fail? But they were enjoyable in the way that they were good, enjoyable stories that I now feel I will revisit again, but they weren't like, they didn't blow me away, as James said. They didn't, they're not going to be a Genesis of the Daleks.
No, there's nothing like that.
Yeah, no, but I like them. And yeah, that's all I can really ask for right now, is if they keep giving me stories that I like, you know, I'm not going to really label this season a fail if everyone is, hey, they have been enjoyable. That to me is a great win. I would love to have them be incredible. But what I really want is for the show to just be good and enjoyable, for me to enjoy it again. And so far, I've got that from these two episodes. And hopefully that continues and even keeps getting better. I mean, and I really liked things too, like how this episode was, you know, it was basically the arc in space, you know, another arc in space. It was
I was going to mention these references to the classic series, because you've got the arc and you've got the arc in space.
Right. And you've got Bill saying Wicked like Ace, which I also thought was fun.
Yeah, you've got that as well. And you've also got the other things that are sort of like tied to that, because Trial of a Time Lord is partially tied to the arc in space as well, isn't it?
And we had the Starship London in his Beast Below as well, which shouldn't be forgotten.
The only thing I didn't like going through these, like when we're talking about that now, since you have so many ties to so many other ones, you know, the Doctor was talking about, well, we can't blow this ship up because if we do, or if these robots kill them, that's the end of the human race. And then it's like, but wait, just like 2 minutes ago, you just said that this was one of the arcs that left Earth, and you have seen plenty of other ones. That wouldn't be the end of the human race.
Yeah, but he doesn't know.
But, you know, where the others okay, are dramatic point, effect, whatever. But,
yeah. And yeah, then there's also there's a Seat of Doom reference as well, isn't there?
Oh, did I miss that one? What was that one?
Well, it wasn't an explicit reference. The dead bodies on fertilizer.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay.
Which is, for a 7:20 in the evening show, the reason why my 5.5, well, nearly 6-year-old son won't be watching Smile.
Well, again, that is still a concern, you know, with ratings being an issue, and if the show originally being commissioned as a family show, it's still not feeling like it's sitting in that bracket, which, as much as I'm loving it at the moment. And to be honest, I think that story could have been toned down a little and wouldn't have lost its edge. You don't think you needed the skulls.
No.
That seemed a little gratuitous. Again, I don't mind as an adult, doesn't faze me. But no, if you're looking at wide demographic, that seemed to be sort of pushing it in areas it didn't need to push.
I'm just curious, because I would just like a Christian to expand a little bit, because I don't have kids, so I don't really know. But the question is, would you show your son The Seeds of Doom?
Would I show my son Seeds of Doom? No.
Is the difference the skulls, or is it just people fertilizer?
I think it's the mode of death and the bundle of skulls coming out of the bottom drawer.
Sure.
Okay. I mean, I think more for this episode, it was the teaser, and you know, two women, you know, a woman sort of quite horrifically murdered and then graphically turned into skulls was quite a brutal scene. I mean, the same with Seeds of Doom, I wouldn't show a kid because of the sort of body horror factor to it, rather than the, to be honest, I always thought that was kind of funny how the whole, that scene is the sort of big contention. Well, to me, for kids, I still think kids don't have that sort of separation that adults do of reality, and sort of say, well, that's a grotesque death being fed into one of those machines. Or I think a lot of kids would be more upset about being stung by an alien thing which would slowly turn them into a horrible creature and make them look ugly. I think that's far more visceral for a child. Mm-hmm. But adults don't see it that way, and they focus on the wrong things. It's like Water of Mars, isn't it, where the whole issue was that she had a gun with a bullet in the end that had to be changed to a laser gun because, you know, of suicide and bullets. And yet you'd had a story all the way through where one touch of water robbed you or your family or your friends of all their humanity, which I think is a terrifying thing for a kid.
Yeah.
So it's a funny how we sort of swing around about some things like that.
But. Yeah. Well, I mean, our Bruce has been having, like, one day last week, he had a nightmare of having his arm chewed off by a rat.
Hmm.
No idea where that came from. Yeah, you need to be really careful what you put in front of little eyes, I think, and try and view it from all angles. Well, you can't be completely successful now. I mean, I still remember nightmares that I had when I was a child.
Well, as I say, when I was a child, I was terrified of Posh Paws from Swap Shop, which was a purple puppet which sat next to Noel Edmonds and roared occasionally. And that freaked me out as a kid. So you can never totally hide, you know, you can never tell what a kid's going to be, you know, scared of. But there are some things which I think from your own experience, you can sort of say that might be a catalyst.
Yeah, I was scared of Sweetums in The Muppet Show as well.
So. Well, that's it, you know, and it's you can't escape things like that. But, you know, you can escape showing them things which are sort of could have very logical fears for a child. And I think things like you've always got to be careful with things which you've got metamorphosis or show people in high states of fear. I think that's sometimes a problem. But that, you know, obviously can't be helped because that's on most dramas. But
Doctor Who News.net are reporting that Smile had an overnight viewing figure in the UK of 4.25 million viewers, which was 22.9% of the total audience. The pilot last week had 4.64 million, which was 24.8% of the share. So second episodes always dip, don't they? And then it finds its correct area. I'm a little bit disappointed that it's gone down so much. The pilot, though, back to last week's episode, has had an audience appreciation. What's that mean? An audience appreciation figure of 83, which is considered good. Yeah. So that's reassuring.
I'll be honest. I'm not surprised by the dip in ratings, considering Series 9 had such bad ratings in comparison to the previous years. Because the audience was just losing their appreciation because the stories weren't worth it. There was no, we've been all over it. There were so many issues with it. Fans were just dropping off. And I expect that with what's going on with these first two episodes, if this trend continues, other fans are going to keep hearing word that the show is better. It fixed these issues. It's so much better. It's enjoyable. And I think we're probably going to see the ratings start to creep up as more fans hear that they should tune back in. Which is, you know,
I guess
a little sad that people aren't just checking it out to see maybe things got better. But it would be nice if it comes back to what it was.
I don't share your optimism. I don't think that's I have this feeling. It's like someone was saying with opposition leaders in politics in the UK that if they start on a downward turn, it never rises. It never spikes. I have a horrible feeling for that large majority, which is of normal, we call them normal, of non-fan audiences who will have turned away to do the sizable drop. I think it'll be very hard push to get them to put the effort in to give it another chance, unless the papers, as you say, unless there is a large public surge of support from it from the media, which might get people to start going to see what the hubbub is. I can't see that making a massive change this series. I think if there's going to be a change, it'll be when there's a fresh face with a fresh promo behind it, PR behind it, for a fresh era. Then I could see people tuning in to see what happens. I have a horrible feeling that while I think this is going to have a good AI throughout, it's not going to get the people watching it until Capaldi leaves. And I think like McCoy, people will go back and then go, oh, actually, this was actually quite good then. I wish we'd known about this, or I wish I'd stopped watching it as a kid and started watching Coronation Street.
Two things right there that you just said. I was actually going to ask you, and you actually just kind of answered it, but I'm even more curious about a second part of this. With Chibnall coming in with a new doctor, do you really think that would bring in more of the casual viewers, or do you think that's just going to keep the actual returning fans coming back a little bit more? Like, do we think that the ratings as they are is kind of going to be the new base because the casual fans dropped off during the Moff era? Which I agree with what you're saying, that it could bring them in, but I'm curious, like, if I'm a casual viewer, how am I really going to be aware that there's been a total change aside from just seeing an actor's face?
I think we've got a problem with the audience age, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
My nieces didn't know the Doctor Who was coming on couple of weeks ago. They had no idea it was coming on. It hasn't been on for, you know, there hasn't been a series on for 18 months. Now, one of them is, what year is it, right? One of them's 13, the other one's going to be 12 later this year. So that's the age where children should be watching Doctor Who. They don't even know it's coming on. So where's the advertising for a start off? We've heard that they're not bothered about younger children at the moment with Doctor Who. They've been abandoned completely. So that's a big chunk of your viewing audience gone there as well.
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
Although the show is clearly trying and succeeding, I think, to a certain degree, in reformatting itself, we've got to ask, who do they think the audience is? Because at the moment, it looks like that they think the audience are people at university and above.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Which could make sense
when you think about it. It could be the fans. They're trying to capture the 2005 fans that started with the show, trying to stick with them.
But I think the problem is that the reason Doctor Who over here carried on for so long is that it had... One, as we've always said, it had change sort of built into its matrix, and it's quite a severe change compared to the change we've had in the new series tenure. But it was also aimed at an age which was constantly revolving, so people would grow out of Doctor Who and new people growing into it. So it could have that sort of circular young age group constantly built into its core audience, providing you kept it focused so that age group could actually get into it. And you can. Some people would argue, and I'm not saying this is true, I've never looked into it, they could argue that the 80s, certainly the mid-80s, anniversary series season onwards up until McCoy, there was a sort of... it became a far more adultish show, which perhaps made it harder for kids to get into, and maybe that sort of saw some of the rating issues. I mean, you know, Remembrance of the Daleks certainly was a very hard show for children. It was getting quite brutal by that point. And by Collins' era, it was very brutal from what people would normally expect. So,
okay, listen, I've just had a look at this while you've been talking. Doctor Who Magazine, this is figures from last August. Doctor Who Magazine increased its circulation in the first half of 2016 compared with the same period in 2015. That period was 25,832. Up from 25,663. That's the official circulation. Now, a little while before that, Doctor Who Adventures was picked up by Panini. So that moved from its old home at BBC Magazines and went to Panini. That now, as of August 2016, has a certified circulation of 11,268, down from 20,506 in the equivalent 6 months in 2015. At its peak in 2010, Doctor Who Adventures had over 50,000 readers.
Yeah.
Now, there's clearly a disconnect between the magazine that focuses at the child audience and the programme that the magazine's about.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, I mean, statistics are always hard to sort of pull apart, but if on a sort of, you could casually surmise, and you've also got to take into account that the Doctor Who magazine doesn't just cater for fans of the show. I know a lot of Doctor Who fans who will say, I'm a fan of the classic series. I don't watch the new series.
I'm not so much so bothered about the Doctor Who magazine side,
I'm saying that statistics are sort of surface on the surface.
Sure.
I know what you're saying. I'm just saying that sometimes we've always got to be wary that but what I was actually trying to say there was not to disregard your point, was to actually sort of say that if you're looking at the Doctor Who magazine to sort of say, is this a sort of 18 to 35 year old audience that, you know, that sort of a market group that the show might be focusing on, 18 to 40 or whatever, is that, does the Doctor Who magazine not just cater for the new series, but caters beyond that? So it's not necessarily indicative of his audience. Indicative of people who are not watching his show at all, while the Doctor Who Adventures is very much indicative, really, of those who will probably just be watching the TV show or were, and perhaps getting to see some of the old episodes when they could. I think what you're saying is a very good point. Sorry, I didn't mean to sort of go off on a tangent there. It is a really interesting and revealing sort of set of statistics.
Yeah. Statistics there for a moment. I want to hit on another thing James had said, which was kind of you harken back to the Sylvester McCoy era, and it's again going back to something we said earlier in the podcast, that it seems like series 10 is on the right footing, which is a shame, just as Capaldi is on his way out the door, rather than like, hey, things have picked up, let's have another one with him. It's really kind of echoing the classic series there. Rather than the show coming to an end, Sylvester McCoy's era really came into its own in his last season and really picked up and deserved another season, but it was canceled prior to. Whereas here, Capaldi feels like he's going to deserve this other proper season, but he has left.
Well, there was a YouTube video I saw last week, and I can't remember whose it is. Maybe worth us trying to dig it up, because it's his idea, not mine. And he was speculating that sort of consistency with the old series, but he was marking Tennant as Baker, then Smith as Davison, and Capaldi as Colin. And on that, you could perhaps even argue that Capaldi's done what they argued that they wanted to do with Colin, and start him off rough and then make him warmer as it went along. Maybe, you know, Capaldi's had a little bit of that arc. So the next one after this would be McCoy, which actually would make sense in the sense that we have heard very strong feelings from BBC that this is going to be that Chibnall's era is going to be more focused on the kids at an earlier time slot. And, you know, it's going to be aimed at a sort of broader audience, which you'd have to argue McCoy's rather badly at first was trying to do. It was, the style of it was far less coarse, you know, without Soward there. It was a far less brutal show that was opened up to a wider audience, but it didn't know how to do it at first. It didn't even have that sort of edge that Soward brought, you know, whether you liked all his era or not. He had a style which was very definitive. And it just sort of went everywhere for that first season. So maybe Chibnall's could be reflective of the McCoy era. And then we've got to say, will he get time, if that's the case, to find his shoes as Cartmell managed to find for McCoy's era within that time. So it'll be interesting if we do have that parallel.
Let's hope we don't.
Let's hope we don't.
You know what would be really interesting, though? Another thing Christian had kind of mentioned earlier in the beginning, like what if, or one of us, I believe it was Christian, but what if... this whole Capaldi leaving thing was a ruse kind of thing. And what if he is going to stick around for Chibnall? The reason it's a compelling idea to me, and I'm very doubtful of it actually being the case, would be what if series 10 could achieve what series 1 failed, but they tried so hard to do, which was surprise us at the end with the regeneration of the Doctor in series 1. It was given away after like the first episode when we were told Christopher Eccleston was leaving. But what if here having Peter Capaldi say, yeah, I'm going, would be the surprise ending to series 10? You know, like you think he's going to regenerate, and then there he is going, hey, I'm back, you know, and like just surprise us all, like, oh my God, we get to keep him, you know, kind of thing. It would be very strange for them to go through all of the press that they're doing to say that he is leaving to turn it around. So I doubt it would happen. But man, you have to admit that would get us pretty good if they did.
It might be somewhat self-indulgent, perhaps, as well. Or it might be viewed that way by a few people as well. I've just spotted another parallel between Smile and previous episodes. Smilers in The Beast Below.
Yeah, I thought that when they did the emoji thing at the beginning, I was thinking that reminds me of the Turning Heads.
Yeah, I'd missed that completely.
There's also links to The Girl Who Waited as well.
Of course, yeah, yeah.
So there are a few links throughout. I think going back to that one, I was saying that there was that mirror to the classic timeline. You could argue that repeat of time has actually been broken by having the series 10. Because if you think of Colin Baker's era where he only gets the two series, and you think the first series he's really Bruce, then the second series for Trial of the Time Lord, he's a lot lighter and perhaps overly light and a bit sort of neutered and vapid. That's sort of very much where Capaldi was in series 9. But instead of being knocked out of the ballpark and getting another series to perhaps, you know, find his footing, Capaldi's got that. So maybe that continuity has already been finished and we're not going down that route, and there's a bright, shiny future. And going back to Brian's question earlier about whether casuals would come back for a new doctor, I think they would, providing that doctor has reasonable agency for majorities. And that's why I still feel the Chris Marshall thing has validity, because as much as I'm starting to see a bit of a backlash now of people saying, bloody Chris Marshall, he's just too obvious, it's too predictable. It's like, well, yeah, but the show's in dire straits. They want someone broad that has a broad interest, and someone who is noted for BBC One and shows to do with the BBC, because in the end, that's who commissions it. So I think,
okay,
yeah, they would
Chris
come back.
Marshall, to be honest. I don't know how
I think
feel,
a lot of audience, yeah. Well, yeah, I don't know. No, I'm not sure, because I'm really enjoying Capaldi now. So I'll be disappointed when I would like to have seen him, if he carried on like this, go for another year. But as we know, he's not, and they're going to sort of do this soft reboot with a new face. I think that is their best way of bringing people back, if they do the earlier time slot and start and getting the kids back into it, which I think is going to irate a few hardcore fans. But I reckon those hardcore fans will still watch.
I didn't want Eccleston to go. What we're having right now is what I wanted to see. I wanted to see somebody give him the stories that he deserves. And I'm hoping this season continues that, because that's what I really want for Peter Capaldi. But I didn't want him to go. But knowing that he's going, and I had no idea who I even wanted to replace him. I really didn't think there was anybody out there at this point. But after watching a lot of Death in Paradise lately, and independent of this news that he may be the Doctor, I've just actually been watching the show for a couple months, a year or whatever now, whatever. I like him. I can see Doctor tendencies in him, and it would be nice if that rumor turns out to be true, because I think he would do well in the role.
Funnily enough, I think he would do well if he actually mirrors more of what Capaldi's doing now than if he mirrors a youthfulish doctor, even though he's not that youthful, he's, 44, a youthfulish doctor and starts doing the Matt Smithisms. I think actually what Capaldi does is more what he does well in Death in Paradise, which is a far more sort of gentle approach than perhaps his work of eccentricity on My Family, where he was a far more sort of crazy character. I think what he's doing on Death in Paradise would probably translate quite well into Doctor Who if they were doing this sort of feel to the stories, where it's not, because I suppose this is what people have said a lot of, you know, people have always said for the new series, it's always been so horrendously Doctor centric that the world revolves around the Doctor, that the, and so the companion revolves around the Doctor as well. Everything is about the Doctor. And now we're not really having that as much. The Doctor in this last episode is doing what, you know, you've wanted for a long time, Brian, and that's sort of come into a place with maybe a rough idea of what it's about, but he doesn't have a coherency to it. It's not all about him. It's him exploring, finding an issue, starting to realize he doesn't have to resolve it, and then finally resolving it. And that's kind of exciting.
It absolutely is. But I will say that, like, one concern with Chris Marshall is when Peter Capaldi was cast, everybody, there were memes galore, there were jokes, everything, that it was going to be Malcolm Tucker in the TARDIS. And while he didn't have the language, we got the crotchety nature, essentially, of the character with Capaldi. And while Chris Marshall in Death in Paradise has that kind of bumbling, you know, he's a nice guy, like you said, he's not an idiot, but he does have that bumbling nature. He's accident prone and so on. My concern would be that would be the thing that got him cast. Whereas I would like to see them kind of break the mold of, this is the role that he did previously, we think it would translate well to Doctor Who. You know, I would like to see that maybe not necessarily be the case. And as you said, maybe be a little bit more like Capaldi is currently,
which is interesting, because when you see Capaldi interviewed at the moment, especially, he seems, I think you're right in a way that they sort of wrote him as a more sort of, if Malcolm Tucker was an alien. When in the end, if you write it like that, as often is the way where you write it almost like the persona of the actor rather than the character they previously played, you see Capaldi interviewed, he has that sort of confidence and sort of gentle tone and rhythm that this Doctor has. There doesn't seem to be that much difference, but when I see Capaldi interviewed as seeing the Doctor in this series, he seems a sort of very similar body language and sort of when he's just talking, it feels like him, not Malcolm Tucker. So I think what we've got now is perhaps more of that, as you say, that sort of normal Doctor Who sort of paradigm of this, you know, the actor becomes, the actor's persona imbues the Doctor. And that's perhaps becoming more naturalistic in this one than it was in Series 8, where it was, as you say, Michael Tucker becomes the Doctor.
Yeah. I think the only one that hasn't really done that with is Matt Smith, because Tennant was quite close to his Casanova.
Yeah, he's not very much like... I mean, there is a bit of a sort of boyishness about Tennant, but it's not like Tennant per se, is it?
No.
I mean, Davidson's obviously like the vet, a bit like the vet, but I would say the Davison Doctor, I would still say that has elements of Davison in him as well. There's a sort of natural buoyance, vibrancy that Davison had then, which, when you see him interviewed, which is there in both characters.
Yeah, I think this. I think you can. I think you can draw a line to Tristan, but I don't think he's quite very different. So yeah, I think you're probably
he is
right.
Very different. Yeah. I've been watching it lately. It's like he is far more different than people realise. So I think that's far more Davis-ing.
Yeah, Smith also had more freedom than a lot of the other new series doctors had, starting from Tennant on, because Christopher Eccleston obviously had a very varied career. But Smith was basically new to a majority of people, and the roles that he had done that got him selected basically were not really big standout ones. And not to downplay him as an actor, but what I mean by that is like he wasn't known as a Malcolm Tucker, or he wasn't known for Death in Paradise. So he wasn't known for a very specific character type, so he had no mold to either stick to or break. He was moldable for the show. So he had that freedom, which was quite good for his character. But that is something, and I can understand why they would want to go after a specific actor for a specific trait and a specific character that they played before. But you would think that they would want to distance it at the same time from something that had come before, especially the actor, you would think, would really want that.
I suppose so. In each case, often the cases they do either establish it based on a sort of character that they sort of reflecting this Doctor would be good on, they've seen before, or the personality that they create that then slowly starts to mold a little more into the personality of the actor. I mean, like Tom Baker, for instance, his first season is quite straight and it starts to become more anarchic, like the bohemic character Baker as it moves along. Same with Sylvester McCoy. First year is a very odd year where they're not quite sure where to take him. But then, you're still doing the spoons, wasn't you, in the first year? And he did have a bit of input in the character, but the second year seemed to be more where he felt his comfort zone was.
You know what? That's amazing you just said that, the spoons. The spoon from, what was that Sherwood episode, series 8, I guess that was, when the 12th Doctor fought Robin Hood with a spoon, a sword and a spoon.
Oh, yes.
That's something that's completely missing from series 10, which is amazing. We're not getting absurdity to the level of completely unbelievable.
Well, yeah, that was always the problem, wasn't it, though? They did that a lot in series 9. In series 8, it was either absurdity or Malcolm Tucker. And now they seem to have found, as we said last episode, I'm still not sure about the guitar. I like the guitar in a way because it's a bit of Capaldi in there, and that's cool. But I still don't really equate it with that personality. It's too eccentric almost. It's too contrived.
You know, we're all guitar players, as I guess a lot of our listeners know. And I enjoy that aspect because, to be honest, I kind of thought it would be cool if the Doctor did one day. You know, he's how old? You'd think he'd learn these instruments. But I don't think it needs to be like the staple thing, the thing he's known for. You know, it certainly doesn't come across as the recorder for the Second Doctor. But I don't mind that quite as much. But more so, what's more so important to me is they're not just throwing in absurdity for absurdity's sake.
Exactly.
And that is something that it's quite amazing watching these two episodes. I hadn't really picked up on was fixed just because they worked. You know, like it's, you know, instead of sitting there going, oh, it's so much better because I was just happy that they worked and they were enjoyable. And now thinking about it, it's like, man, that's it. Like either Moffat listened or he just thought, hey, this would be a way to change things up. Whatever decision he made to make this be the fresh start that it was, seems like they're off to a good start. And I'll be honest, I have a slight fear. I'm excited that John Sim is going to be back, and even Michelle Gomez, because both of them, to me, were enjoyable on screen. I have a feeling this is where the absurdity is going to come out in the stories, though, and where things are going to start to fail. I have a feeling that Moffat is going to fall back into his old habits once he has the two of them together on screen. So while things are looking good now, I kind of have a feeling we're in for some bleak, old-fashioned series 8 or 9 issues. When we get to that story.
We can still say that at the same time, and I do agree with you. I'm trying to say to myself, I thought and I predicted before this came up that there was going to be a sort of fusion, horrid fusion, where they'd take Power of the Daleks, the Mavellans, and try and do a prequel to Power of the Daleks that would link in with the DVD release. Mm. And they haven't. The Mavellans were a background piece to a fight that included the Daleks and were only relevant to the fans in a way that they should have only been, that you didn't need to do that for new fans. It was, that would have been the sort of same mistake they did with Davros and the Daleks last series, and they haven't. So maybe,
yeah, it worked well.
Maybe that they will learn from this and they will realize
it would be great
that Capaldi can step back and let Sim and Gomez just be absurd as they want, and he can just, they don't have to have him join in to sort of compete. And it's this competing that just needs to stop, this competing between companion and doctor. And even in this one, it's worth remembering as well, even though, and if you think of a second episode Doctor Who stories with the companion, companion normally comes through and makes a massive, does a massive thing to change the day quite frequently. And in this, a bit like with End of the World, there isn't that moment. She sort of comes back and she takes him to the dead body, and she talks to the colonists and the boy, but she's not actually taking over. She's not actually proving that she is equal to the doctor. It's the doctor who saves it, who completes
it. Well, she's doing the brilliant thing of being the human and noticing the human elements and the things that he would miss. And, you know, admittedly, you know, I talked about that one fear, but my other fear is that they're going to do the thing where she becomes the super companion, or that, you know, running from danger is going to be the fun thing. I really hope they break that mold and they have her stay true to how they've written her right now by pointing out those things, like you just said, in Smile, and also by, you know, enjoying the time travel, enjoying the travel itself, but the danger is kind of more like, look, it's a bad situation that we're here, but we're here, so I'm going to help fix this with you, rather than, hey, man, that's so awesome, Cybermen, that's so cool, let's go fight the bad guys. You know, I would love to see that more realism. And I think she, so far, has been playing very real. And when I was watching it, I actually said to my wife, too, I said, you know, having her be a lesbian is a great thing for many reasons, for people who will relate to her in that way. But also, you're not going to have that old tried and true method of the new series of the love relationship, or those unrequited feelings between the doctor and the companion. You'll still get fans wanting to ship them, whatever. But it's not, it's going to be that friendship dynamic that works so well in the classic series. And so it seems like so many things are just working right off the bat here.
Where was the gay reference to this episode? There were none, which was really encouraging. That I'd have thought last series before that, I'd have expected each episode that had been a written in innuendo that would play out somewhere, and there was none. It was played totally straight. It was not important.
And that's a beautiful thing.
Her reaction when she suddenly realised, you know, she's dealing with a dead mother's son, was not one of joy. It seemed quite real. And as you say, I kind of hope they keep playing that, because it's not rushing around the galaxy having fun. She's just witnessed a child having to discover that they've just lost their mother. And that's a, you know, really horrific thing that no counsellor would say is a rip-roaring part of their job. Why would anyone else, unless you're a sociopath? So, yeah, I think it's played well.
So, yeah, excellent. Okay. I've got a couple of things to just go back to that I mentioned earlier in the podcast. There's been some... When we were talking about the reflections thing, there is a rumour going around that Earth isn't Earth.
Right.
But a reverse Earth, or perhaps a twin Earth.
Oh, man. Oh. If this is my idea...
Well, I don't know, Brian, that, if it's your idea
that
or
I
not.
Have, that I have spoke about publicly, I will not be upset if Moth takes it, because I want it to be my idea. But go on.
Nothing, you're not. That would be... If it's what I think he's thinking, that would be... It would be a little too...
Well, I'm going to leave it there. I'm going to leave it there. There's also... There is another thing as well with regards to the Master and Missy, and... whether or not they're actually simultaneously in the same episode or not, as has been suggested, there's a like a Reddit thread discussing this, that perhaps actually he regenerates into her in the episode, but we'll have to wait.
There's been an interview with Moffat where he sort of say they play off against each other.
I was just going to say there was that, but I wouldn't be surprised if the episode ends with a regeneration scene.
No, not at all.
I kind of feel like it's going to be like the 50th anniversary where he covered all the regenerations that were missing for the Doctor. And yeah, whatever. That's fine. I think I would rather see them interact because the interest behind the two of them together is a multi-master story, which we haven't had. And that seems fun. We've had multi-doctor. It seems interesting to see it from the other side.
Indeed. Just one other thing as well. I think we're probably going to have to wrap up the podcast after this.
Yes.
But a lot of the people with less than... Well, the people that are showing some dissatisfaction with the idea of Chris Marshall as a Doctor are people who don't watch Death in Paradise. But they are people who know Chris Marshall from Love Actually, the Richard Curtis movie, in which he plays a guy who travels to America to basically get sex from American women. There's a moment at the airport which he shouts, America, watch out, here comes Colin Frissell, and he's got a big knob. Which obviously works well in the cinema. I'm going to let you all into a secret now, because I bet I'm the only person who knows about this. Because I don't imagine that any of our listeners are sad enough to go through, or interested enough, to go through the meta information on the podcast. But I very often leave quotes, either from the podcast, or from Doctor Who, or from whatever we're talking about, within the metadata of the MP3 files in the podcasts. And last week's podcast was America, watch out, here comes Colin Frissell, and he's got a big knob.
Oh, my God.
So there you go. And we've previously discussed this, chaps, and from next week we're renumbering the podcasts as well.
Okay.
Because we've reached Season 6, Episode 52, which means that James, Brian, and I have been podcasting together for... 5 seasons of podcasts.
Good Lord. I didn't even know we had seasons of podcasts.
Yeah, we do. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Did you know this, Brian? Is it just me who was unaware that I was being, that I was in this sort of rigorous taxonomy of seasons?
We
don't have finales.
I was aware, but it was something that I thought only we talked about. I didn't know listeners might be aware.
No,
but
well, yeah. I don't know if the listener is aware or not, but other podcasts use numbers, so we're going to start using numbers once I work out what the numbers actually are. I have no idea what the numbers are.
Well, good luck to you.
Thanks.
So how many? We're season six.
Yeah, we're in the 300 sort of area.
Bloody hell.
So, yeah, probably a bit more than that. But, so that's the end of this week's podcast with...
I mean, do people realise...
Oh, it's not. Sorry, what?
Do people realise if they've listened to every one of those bloody podcasts with my voice in, they've probably heard me more than most of my family? You've heard me talk most of my family. Certainly, you've heard my voice more than any of the poor women who've ever had to date me. You've had me in your ear in ways which most people really wouldn't. That's like
further
400
to that,
hours, I don't know. Yeah.
Further to that, though, we have people actually willingly listening to us, whereas generally in my life, people willingly try not to listen to me.
Yeah, yeah. No, I have that as well. It's great.
Yeah.
It's great. It's a captive audience. So thank you.
I mean, thanks.
Yeah, yeah. Thanks, listener.
Yeah.
That smell. Let us know what you think.
Can we change that from if we're going into numbers next time, we can change the listener to idiot?
No, I think that's going too far.
Really?
I think we'd be the idiot.
Yeah.
Maybe the idiot needs to actually, I suppose, what is it, 300? I think we really know who the idiots are.
Yeah. So until next time, it's goodbye from us.
This is a Beyond Casterbrus podcast. Available on iTunes, Audioboom, Stitcher.com, Player FM, and BeyondCasterbrus.com.